to the podcast of the City Club of Eugene, Oregon. The City Club builds community vision through open inquiry and is dedicated to enabling an informed public on a wide range of topics. Coming up in today's program.
What I want to do today is to look at about how we have addressed earthquake issues in California, where we've had successes, where we've had failures, and then think about what lessons we can learn from that to how we apply it to the climate crisis.
We appreciate the sponsors who make our civic work possible, including Kaiser Permanente, kp.org, Lane Community College, lanecc.edu, Peace Health, peacehealth.org, the University of Oregon, uoregon.edu, Lane County, and the City of Eugene. And here's today's program.
Welcome to the City Club of Eugene. My name's Eric Richardson, and I serve as president of the City Club of Eugene. Support for the City Club is provided by our members and sponsors. You can become a member of the City Club at our website, cityclubofeugene.org. You are also able, through our website, to present any kind of ideas around programming that you might want to see. So please, I'd like to move on to today's program by welcoming today's program coordinator. Please welcome to the mic Joe Corin.
The usual way that we have moved things forward is have a disaster and then respond to it. And somebody decides they want to blow up a plane with an explosive in their shoes, and the rest of us are taking off their shoes for years to come before we can get on an airplane. Maybe we don't have to do that. Dr. Lucy Jones, who is our speaker today, came up with a wild concept called planning ahead. And she was able to convince the California legislature to pass seismic safety legislation even when there wasn't a major earthquake in California. And then began thinking, what else can we do to use that concept, this wild concept of planning ahead, with respect to climate policy? And that's what she's going to talk about today, planning ahead before the disaster happens. If you watch TV during the California earthquake, Dr. Jones was a constant presence. She was on TV more than Lester Holt. She has an incredible background. She's a seismologist, a natural disaster expert, and she worked at the U.S. Geological Survey, where she led to the creation of national science strategy for all the natural hazards studied by the USGS to promote science that would better prepare the nation for future natural disasters, and the development of science products that would make information more accessible to decision makers. She also has founded the Dr. Lucy Jones Center for Science and Society, with a mission to foster the understanding and application of scientific information. She wrote the book, The Big One, and is also research associate at the Seismological Laboratory at Caltech. Now, in addition to that, I learned at the table that she has also walked the red carpet with The Rock at the premiere of a movie called San Andreas. I've never introduced a speaker that has been on the red carpet before. Now, Dr. Jones is here in Oregon as the Wayne Morse Chair with the Wayne Morse Center at the University of Oregon. Established in 1983, the Wayne Morse Chair honors Senator and a former Dean of the UO Law School, Wayne L. Morse. Other people who have held this position have been Judge Abner Mikva, Chief Wilma Mankiller, Senator Russ Feingold, Vandana Shiva, Joseph Antonio Vargas. Dr. Jones is the first scientist to hold this post. Now, some of the concepts she will talk about today are hard to explain. But in the words of that immortal 1950s and 60s great philosopher, Ricky Ricardo, Lucy, you got some explaining to do.
You know, I Love Lucy was one of the worst things about growing up named Lucy in the 60s and still coming back for me. Thank you for having me. I'm trying to figure out how much background to give. I had to listen to how much they wanted to tell here, and it's sort of a sign you know you're getting old when you're looking at how much time you need to explain what brought you to the place that you are. As you heard, I'm a research seismologist. I spent most of my career with the U.S. Geological Survey researching earthquake statistics, trying to explain risk to people, trying to explain probabilities. Came to realize that while people may understand probabilities, they pretty clearly don't make decisions with probabilities. And I needed to really shift what I was doing if I wanted our science used to make a difference in California. So my role was always in Southern California. I was stationed at Caltech for all of my career, and I completed my federal service 3 years ago. I'm still associated with Caltech. And in this process of saying, how do we get our science used? We reached a point where we had the opportunity to create a new program and try and connect. And we spent time talking to stakeholders in the Southern California community. What do you want from science that you're not getting? The most important message we got is we want scenarios of what these disasters are. We know we're supposed to be getting ready for an earthquake, but we don't know what the earthquake is. And that process of being asked to do this helped me shift my science towards really looking at the impacts of the disasters and putting it into terms that could be received by policymakers. And then proceeded to start doing more and more work with policymakers, and I actually spent the year of 2014 at Los Angeles City Hall working with the mayor to help develop seismic safety policies. Since then, and especially once I'm no longer a government employee constrained to talk only about what my own individual science is, I have found myself, as I understand more about what's happening with the climate crisis, finding it difficult to argue to spend much effort on seismic safety. What is coming from the climate crisis, if we do nothing, could well wipe out our society before the earthquake up here especially has any time to happen. So I've been really trying to understand what comes together. How do I look at the science? How do I look at the communication? And I've come to believe that we are dealing with actually a very similar problem when dealing with seismic policy or climate policy. In both cases, you're having to listen to scientists come up with a relatively abstract idea. We create models, we study the data, create a model, say, according to our model, I can tell you what's coming in the future, and it's going to be something awful. And if you don't want to suffer that something awful, you really got to do something now to change it. But you're having to listen to the abstract model of the scientist and process that to spend money now to prevent a future harm. And that's a really difficult problem to get. It's even more difficult for elected officials. When I was doing this work with Mayor Garcetti, there was an editorial about it in a local newspaper, and it's talked about why elected officials have always ignored seismic safety. Said there's only, you know, if they go and they invest political capital, they invest money and effort towards trying to change something about the earthquake risk, there's only two possible outcomes. One, there's no earthquake before they're out of office, and the people look at them and said, why'd you waste the money? Or there will be an earthquake before they're out of office, and their programs won't have had time to make a difference, and they'll look ineffective. So that it was always a lose-lose for any elected official to deal with the problem. And historically, I think that's right. And what I want to do today is to look at about how we have addressed earthquake issues in California, where we've had successes, where we've had failures, and then think about what lessons we can learn from that to how we apply it to the climate crisis. The first seismic policies really got started about 100 years ago in California. There's one significant difference between California and Oregon. We both have really big earthquakes in our future, but California has moderate earthquakes now. And it is without question that those have helped us focus and understand what's coming. And of course, the first earthquakes, the 1925 Santa Barbara earthquake that destroyed a lot of Santa Barbara, was at a time when we really didn't understand much about how the earthquake process happened. In fact, it, go back a little bit more, the 1906 earthquake in San Francisco, probably have heard of it as, you know, it was always talked about as the San Francisco earthquake and fire. And there was a lot of discussion about how it was really the fire that had destroyed the city. That was partly a political calculation that everybody had fires, and therefore, if you had a fire destroy the city, it wouldn't keep people away. But they didn't want to look like particularly dangerous about earthquakes. And as there's actually, over time, we've been able to go and, you know, people have really dug into what happened there and how it was talked about. There are pictures from between the earthquake and the fire that have been doctored to make it look like the buildings were in better shape before the fire came through and destroyed them, right? Yeah, and the estimates actually are about 3,000 dead. It's hard to tell very much because people got up and left. But at the time, we didn't know, and the standard line was actually that earthquakes were like lightning and they never struck twice in the same place. That was also promoted out of San Francisco, again, to keep people from running away. And in fact, people did run away. The largest growth decade in the history of Los Angeles is the decade after the 1906 earthquake, as people gave up on Northern California and moved south to what seemed like a safer place. Of course, it wasn't. 1925, we had an earthquake that badly damaged Santa Barbara and began the first discussions about building codes. You know, we could be building differently if we wanted to. It took the 1933 earthquake to really make a difference. That earthquake happened at about 6 o'clock in the evening on March 10th and completely destroyed 70 schools and damaged a total of about 700 schools, as well as lots of buildings. Because at the time, most of Long Beach was built of brick to be able for fire safety, right? Brick is absolutely the worst possible construction type for earthquakes. I know there are discussions about brick buildings and generally what's called unreinforced masonry, URMs, here in Oregon. They really are bad. I like to call them FPRs for future piles of rubble. The mortar between the bricks dissolves under shaking. If that brick wall is holding up a roof, the roof comes down. Lots and lots of people die. Because of the 1933 earthquake, we got the first seismic provisions ever had in a building code, and we said we aren't going to build brick buildings in California. So our brick buildings in California are all pre-1935. And that was a really very big change. However, nobody was willing to say get rid of brick buildings in other cities. We don't know where the earthquake's going to be. That's going to cost a lot of money. We aren't going to do that. The other thing it brought us is what was called the Field Act. Exactly 1 month after the earthquake, the Field Act was passed, mandating special construction standards for schools and state-level continuous inspection while a building was being built. And that continuous inspection is probably the most important thing. There is somebody on site at all times when a public school is being built. And if they, wait a minute, the plans say 4 feet, you've only dug 3, keep on digging. Wait a minute, you're supposed to have 10 nails there, you've only put in 5, go back. And that happens, and the result has been that Field Act buildings are the safest buildings in the state. Since the Field Act was in place, we have not had a collapse of a Field Act building. Some of the ones built in the 40s have been damaged in later earthquakes, but the level of damage is way, way down. The best comparison, so our community colleges fall under the Field Act because they came out of our high schools. They were trade schools. The state universities do not fall under this because you're going there voluntarily. The Field Act applied to schools that you were told you had to go to. And to actually make it worse, local jurisdictions have no authority over the state, so the local building departments do not inspect state buildings. They're done at the state level. In the 1994 Northridge earthquake, we had two community colleges in the receiving the same level of shaking as Cal State Northridge. The one older college, Pierce College, built in the 40s, had $5 million in damage. Mission College, that had been built in the 80s, had no structural damage at all. And Cal State Northridge, receiving the same level of shaking, had $405 million worth of structural damage. So the FEALD Act has been one of the most successful things we've ever done. I would strongly recommend it as a future method, because children are forced to go to school, and you're putting them at risk. Okay, that was the first seismic policy in California, resulting because of the damage in the Long Beach earthquake. As we went forward, the 1971 San Fernando earthquake almost caused the failure of a dam and caused a brand new hospital to collapse, where the first floor got crushed. The second floor came down onto the first one, killing a lot of patients. It was a veterans hospital, a psychiatric hospital. So it was considered particularly egregious failure. And we then got really strong standards for our hospitals and for our dams. Again, we responded to what happened. We did also get different building codes, because the failure of that brand new building was able to be seen as being a really significant engineering failure, and we changed out those types of buildings. Unfortunately, those types of buildings are all the concrete buildings built in the 50s and 60s, which describes a lot of Los Angeles, right? At least our commercial structures. It continues that way. The Loma Prieta earthquake caused the collapse of the Nimitz Freeway and the damage to the Bay Bridge. We then invested $10 billion in retrofitting our highways. So we now probably, the highways are probably one of the safer places to be in an earthquake going forward. $10 billion does a lot of retrofitting. We do a great job of preparing for the last earthquake. If you look over that California history, there is no legislation that was ever created without a big earthquake to set it off. And that's true until the last decade. There was a process that got going in San Francisco with the centennial of the 1906 earthquake. It was a very slow process, and over 10 years, they finally came up with a community action plan for seismic safety, which was agreed upon in principle by the San Francisco supervisors, but every actual law has to now be passed individually, and they've managed to pass one of them. As this was going forward, though, Mayor Garcetti got elected in Los Angeles in 2013, and I ended up arranging to go talk with him. We told him about what happened. It was about 2 months after he had been elected. And we were wanting to tell him about what was going on in San Francisco, see if we could get a little, you know, city rivalry going, start to get some sort of similar process that would probably take a long time to try and bring it forward. One part of being really fortunate, it really was a coincidence, but the Los Angeles Times published a huge expose of the problems with these non-ductile concrete buildings, the ones that I said got changed after 71, but still are sitting around Los Angeles. Big spread in the LA Times headline thing. This process had been going on for 2 years, and it happened to be published 2 days before my meeting with the mayor. So I had his attention. And we talked about what was possible and what we could potentially do. He was like, okay, I want to do something, but I'm not taking 10 years. I want it in one. And I was like, oh my God, there's a reason it's a 10-year process. How can you do this? We talked about it a while. I went home and I thought about it. And I realized that I had a level of visibility in Los Angeles that would help this go through. And I suggested, you know, would you like to have me come and partner with you to do this? And they said, yes. I went to the U.S. Geological Survey, and probably the more astonishing part is I convinced them to let me do this, because the USGS is a research organization. They are, you know, their money is appropriated by Congress for doing research. And one thing about a federal agency, you have to do what Congress, you know, if you do use your money for something other than what Congress appropriated it for, you get in a lot of trouble, at least that used to be the case in federal agencies. And so, you know, to convince them to let me go in and try to do this was took some doing, but we ended up agreeing to it. We created a technical assistance agreement that said the survey would put up my time, 75% of my time for a year. The mayor would put up his staff time, and together we would explore how to create a seismic resilience plan for California. And that sort of, that's been this interesting process, because I sort of got to get in there and see in depth and in person how the policy creation process works. And I was able to get some shifting in how it was done that I think has been part of how we got it to work. Just from the very beginning, when we set up this technical assistance agreement, the city said, we're not, you know, this isn't create a seismic safety plan. You know, we'll never make it perfect. We say we're making us safe from earthquakes, and the earthquake happens, and, you know, somebody's injured, we'll look bad. What we had to do was to say, we're going to attack three particular problems. We negotiated how many and what we would be doing. And the criteria was that every one of them, we could see something obvious that could be done. We were welcome to go and explore other things, and we structured it so we could put a lot of different things in that structure, but we knew that we could look successful on each of those three items, or could claim success. And that was sort of my first introduction to that political process, which is a really different way of looking at it than the open-ended science way of looking at it. But I also got it, and it was, you know, really, we needed to be able to get to the end. If we wanted people to act, we needed to look successful or they weren't going to be listening to us. So we set up three things of problems of old buildings, the problems in our water system, and problems with telecommunications. That last one's sort of an interesting thing. We were waving our arms and saying, modern society, we need telecommunications. It was also, we knew there was significant issues with the electrical system, and we were really unsure if we could get Los Angeles DWP, the Department of Water and Power, to act on problems with the electrical service. So it was like we created this in a way where we could say we had something else that was successful, and if we could get the Department DWP to move, we could put it in there as part of the process. Spoiler, I'll just tell you that Los Angeles Department of Water and Power really understood their water issues. We have some really big ones, like the pipes in the ground are going to be so badly damaged in the earthquake, it's our estimate it's going to take 6 months to get water back into everybody's houses, problem number one. Problem number two, Los Angeles gets 85% of its water from outside the region, and every drop of that crosses the San Andreas Fault in four different aqueducts. So when the fault goes in a big enough earthquake, every aqueduct gets broken at the same moment. We got a big problem with water, right? But we couldn't get them to believe that they had a power problem. On the power side, they had lost power to the whole city in the Northridge earthquake, and they got it back in 24 hours. Which was an amazing accomplishment, and it was central to their identity. We're the people who got it back. We know how to deal with earthquakes. And I'm like, you know, it's going to be a lot bigger when the San Andreas goes. We know how to deal with earthquakes. You know, you're going to be dependent on power coming in from other regions. We know how to deal with earthquakes. And we finally gave up, basically, and backed off. But it didn't look like a failure because we had structured it to make sure that we didn't claim we were going to get that done. I then spent 10 months in Los Angeles City Hall, working with staff. We met every week, creating ideas about how we could address these various issues. And I wanted to go out and start talking with the stakeholders, because we're talking about requiring people to make a lot of changes in their buildings. We really needed to figure out how they could work with us. And this was another sort of my other big lesson. The deputy mayor for public safety that I was working with was just adamant that we couldn't go talk with people until we knew what we were going to say. That if you come out with a half-baked plan, people are going to tear at you, and then they don't listen to you when you got it done. So we need to really get it settled. And I was like, but how do we know what we're going to say until we've talked with people? And I actually went a bit behind their back and was able to ensure that the mayor's office got asked for me to come and talk with the various organizations, which they then weren't going to turn down. And so I ended up doing 130 public meetings over 10 months, if you want to know how to definition of tired, especially for an introvert, may not be obvious, but I am. And then in that process, I had a talk that I called Imagine America Without Los Angeles. That the idea, you're going to live through the earthquake, You're not going to die in the earthquake, but you may not want to live here later. And if we don't have water, if we don't have power, if our businesses can't come back, people are going to give up and leave. Look at what happened in San Francisco in 1906. That could be us this time around. But then also, so here's the problem. And we know why people will leave. We don't have the water, and we've got all these buildings that we know which ones are going to be killing you. We knew, our models of what the big earthquake's going to be like give us 250,000 households that lose their homes. Right? 250,000 housing units get damaged. We think we have a housing problem now, and we do. Imagine taking another 250,000 units out of the process. So we went through this, and then I said, here's the problem. What do we do about it? Instead of saying, here's the problem, here's our solution. I said, here's our problem. We've thought about these things. What do you think would work? And it meant we engaged them in a discussion of their own buildings. And they were part of the process. And by the time we got done, we had a proposal for mandatory retrofits of the buildings. The city paid nothing. The building owners had to pay all of it. But the city committed to paying for the water issues. So we each had done our part, and they understood why. And the Building Owners and Management Association stood with the mayor and said, we support this, when he released it. And we ended up being able to pass all of the ordinances unanimously. And it is the most extensive legislation ever passed in California, with or without an earthquake. So why? What was successful? One piece of it is that it was based on this very specific model of what the big earthquake would be. We had created what's called the shakeout scenario. If you participated in the shakeout drill, that was originally created to explain the scenario to people. It's sort of taken on a life of its own. But we had a story, and it was a scientifically defensible story. Scientists usually give their information as a bunch of facts. We explicitly avoid stories because stories are misleading. Anecdotes are not the plural of data. They give us the wrong answer. But in fact, people make decisions with stories. So the shakeout story of what the big earthquake would be allowed an emotional connection to it. As I said, we identified the likely opponents and invited them into the discussions at the beginning. So instead of hitting them straight on and attacking them, which is the best way to strengthen a defense, is to attack it straight on. Instead, we were engaging them in a discussion, and it felt like they were part of the process, and they could see their fingerprints on the result. Even if we only took a little bit from them, they were part of the process. I think it was important that I was there. I gave it scientific credibility, but also, I was not hired by the mayor. And I could say to people, and I often did, the price of Mayor Garcetti getting me for free is that he's really getting me. And he has no control over what I'm saying. And that impartiality gave it credibility. And I think that part was really important. And we respected each other. We were able to say, this is my role. I'm providing you science. I did not try to make his decisions for him. I wasn't elected to decide policy for Los Angeles. He was. And so we were able to work together and recognize the places where we fit. One of the interesting things is not only did we get all of this legislation done, it has inspired others. And in the next 4 years, we have seen a dozen other cities adopt mandatory retrofits of these buildings because they saw that Mayor Garcetti didn't get hurt by it. He didn't get looked as, why are you wasting that money? In fact, he got reelected with 81% of the vote. Right? So he got political credibility for doing what was supposed to not have political capital to it. So it was sort of this funny thing, by having the courage to say, I'm going to do something not for political reasons, he got political credit. So now, let's take the turn and say, how does this apply to climate change? If you think about what I've said people need a story to form emotional connections. You can't do this through facts and numbers. You've got to help people understand what's really coming. People need to be part of the process. You can't say, we've come up with this solution, take it. That encourages people to fight back. Instead, if we can, we found a way to connect people as part of creating of it. We had dialogue and respect to people who, from the tenants in the apartments to the apartment owners to the building owners to all the other stakeholders around the city, we talked together about it. And I think the end result that everybody saw that other people were doing their part. They were being asked to sacrifice, but other people were sacrificing as well. And then again, that science policy boundary, we were able to keep clear, this is what the science says. These are potential approaches. And it's not that the policy and the science came really close together, but we recognized that they were different things. When you think about applying this to climate change, you know, usually you need that big event. It's the same reason you guys never seem to be able to get earthquake policies through, because you don't have the smaller events to be able to help remind you what's going on. And that's a really big issue with the climate change. The other thing that's sort of this weird thing is things that are not understood are considered more fearful. There's a group here, Decision Research here in Eugene, Paul Slovic, and the research he's done on risk perception is really important. It's been really useful. But because climate change is understood, it's predicted, and it's slow, all of those make it less frightening in some ways, and it makes it less imperative to get something done. Earthquakes trigger all of our fear buttons and make it a little bit easier. But at the same time, if you really dig into what's happening with climate change, it's terrifying. And it's because the scientists give you the problem, here's how bad it's going to be, but they have not in general wanted to give a solution. That's not our job. The elected officials need to do the policy. We are giving a problem without a solution. And that has been shown clearly by social scientists to increase anxiety and reduce action. So we need to find a way in which the scientists work more closely with the policy people, like I did exploring what the options might be, and doing it in a way, okay, the scientists there say, no, that isn't actually gonna work. Let's really think it through. I think the other part is by not giving the solution, people have had to make up their own ideas about what the solution is. And we've got, you know, ride your Prius, don't take your airplane ride, give up your plastic straws. And that is, one thing, it feels like we're giving up modern life. But the real threat to modern life is not dealing with climate change. That's what's going to bring about food availability, famine, disease, climate refugees, and potentially world war. The real threat is not dealing with it, but by not talking about the solutions, we've let people imagine what it is, and they don't realize that it has to be dealt with, that it's going to get as bad as it's going to get, or what those boundaries are. And I think the last thing I'd like to say, we need real dialogue with all the stakeholders. We've got to figure out how to talk about it rather than just leaving it, here's my solution, take it, or reject it. How about sitting down with all the people? I know this is going to hurt you to give up this type of, have a carbon tax. What can we do to make it more palatable? Right? Somehow figure out how to have that dialogue with everybody, because we're all going to have to be part of it. Or we're never going to get there. And my last comment, we haven't had the disasters so far, but when they come along, we need to make use of them. Luckily, the scientists are doing a better job now of saying that hurricane is worse because of climate change, right? They were getting asked, did climate change cause that hurricane? And I can't say, I don't know that. So we are saying uncertain. Now they're saying it was made worse by climate change, which is something the scientists are comfortable saying. And the more we say that, and the more we get ready to use the really bad ones that are going to be coming in the next few years, that will be open opportunities to finally get action on climate change when we scare people with the immediate event and we can't ignore them. We got a lot of work done with earthquakes. Without the big earthquake, I also have things I'd like to see getting through when we have the earthquake to create the opportunity. And the same thing applies to climate change. So thank you.
If you enjoyed this presentation by the City Club of Eugene, please visit our website at cityclubofeugene.org or our Facebook page for more topics. We hope you are inspired to join us for our next podcast episode.